So we left off at Locke last time. This session is going to be called Empiricism Gives Way to Idealism. Empiricism gives way to idealism. This is an interesting chapter, in a sense, in the history of philosophy, because if you read books on the history of philosophy, you'll see a grouping of the three great English empiricists. Not those guys over there, but it's Locke, and his name is pronounced Berkeley, and Hume. It's interesting because they're the great English empiricists, but two of the three of them were neither English nor empiricists. So I find that interesting because Berkeley was Irish and Hume was Scottish. Neither were empiricists, at least in the same romantically empiricist way that Locke was, because they're going to realize some heavy-duty problems with empiricism. Berkeley's kind of okay with that. Hume is not. But so we're making the first step right here, the first step away from empiricism pretty early on. By the way, usually when an idea is defective, like in the first couple years after the product, you find a warehouse full of the product and nobody really pays attention to it anymore. Strangely enough, empiricism, though it was absolutely disproven within 5-10 years, nevertheless is running our world right now. But I think that goes to show you how little people look at these things and realize the midget behind the curtain as much as they should. But anyway, so let's just take a little pit stop before we get to David Hume with this guy, George Berkeley. And it is pronounced Berkeley, like Sir Charles, not Berkeley, like the college, which mispronounces his name, which was named after him. But that's another story. His dates, Berkeley's dates, are 1685 to 1753. He was a bishop of, I think, Cloyne or Cloyne. I'm not sure how they pronounce it over there, but it's in Ireland. And as I said, he's considered that second of the three British empiricists. But his philosophy is going to immediately differ from empiricism in some obvious ways. Some people have called it immaterialism. Immaterialism, which would immediately suggest anti-empiricism. But the name that most historians have given to his philosophy is idealism. And you'll see why that is. Here's one way to state it very simply so you can see what it's about. And that is that Berkeley held that material objects actually do not possess substantial existence, but rather exist in our ideas of them. So right away, there's a couple mistakes you can make. So he doesn't believe in the reality of the material world, or he believes that things are only in our minds. Both of those, no. That's not what he was saying. But it will sound like that at first. But it's called idealism because the existence of things is primarily in or wrapped up in or reduced to ideas. That, of course, raises the question, okay, what are material objects? What are objects outside of our mind? Well, he's going to address that. But he writes a couple books, not as widely read in his day as Locke was. One was called An Essay Toward a New Theory of Vision. It was in 1709. And in that book, he showed how objects of sight are nothing but light and color. And of course, his critics are going to respond to that. Well, what's light and color? Is that only in our mind? Which again is not what he's saying. But he wrote a couple other books. One was called A Treatise Concerning the Principles of Human Knowledge in 1710. Of course, nobody read that. And so he realized, okay, I'm going to write something in a dialogue form, because people like non-reality, so I'll write it in the form of a story. So he writes what's called Three Dialogues Between Hylas and Philonous in 1713. To get the same idea to a more willing audience. Now, those names are interesting. Philonous. Philo, love in the Greek. Nous, mind. So, one of the interlocutors in the debate is called lover of mind. Okay, that obviously is going to be him. And the antagonist is going to be Hylas, from the Greek word for matter, hyle. So, that person is going to be speaking on behalf of Locke's philosophy and Newton's physics. So the bishop is clearly taking on the whole new world. Locke's empiricism, Newton's physics, and that really explains why he is barely remembered, except as that mispronounced title to an American university who is most famous for students who experience immateriality by alternative means. Berkeley. Anyway, they were idealists too, just a different way. He wrote a couple other books on motion in 1721, and that's where he explicitly challenged Newton's physics. And the reason why he's still remembered, at least by some people, is because later physicists realized, well, he was pretty much articulating what Einstein later would. So maybe he wasn't all crazy. He actually writes a book on apologetics in 1732, and he defends a more historic Christianity against the growing religion of the Enlightenment. So he's very much attacking the deists as well. So, Berkeley actually inherited some money, and he used that to fund a colony in Bermuda and to spread his ideas in the colony of Rhode Island. So what he would do is between 1728 and 1732, for those 4 years, he traveled to America. He donated a bunch of books to the Harvard Library, and he left behind the bulk of his library, which became the beginning of the Yale University Library. And so Berkeley was in New England, spreading his ideas, having some disciples there, right as the seeds of the Great Awakening were just germinating under the soil. So that's very interesting, and there is a connection. So what is this immaterial idealism, and how did it arise in this man's mind in such an empiricist-driven moment? I mean, I said empiricism was disproven within 10 years. Yeah, by Berkeley and people like that, but again, nobody read that, and typically people don't understand things like this, what we're going to look at today, and so empiricism gets the hall pass of being simple to grasp. Even in the academy, when we described what empiricism was, we used the assembly line, picture a plant, if you don't like a head that ideas are moving into. Empiricism basically is this. Here's your, let's get something smaller, if I can not drop it. Here's your head. Here's stuff. Boop. There it is. You're a plant. Sunlight. You're fed, and that's where ideas come from. Pretty simple to understand. That's the sophisticated idea running our world. That's to be tough-minded, concrete, because it's a see that yellow thing right there? I dropped it. It made a noise. Pretty smart, huh? Well, this is the smartest idea ruling the world. So that's easy to understand, and so it doesn't really matter that empiricism is going to be incoherent, because nobody knows what the word incoherent means, because now you're dealing with invisible stuff. Okay, so that's pretty much what Berkeley was doing. Immaterial idealism. Here's the gist of it. First point to idealism is this. There's two main kinds of substance. Spiritual beings and their ideas. So I'll come back to these problems in a second. Spiritual beings, which he's not going to talk about much, and that's going to be, by the way, a deficiency in Berkeley's version. Spiritual beings, which he believes in, but he doesn't really make much of them. So the other thing that is real is ideas. Well, okay, so far so good. And we have to be absolutely clear at this point that Berkeley did not deny the reality of physical objects. He did not deny the reality of this thing making this noise, this piece of wood. But what he did deny is the metaphysical status of such objects as substances in themselves. And so for Berkeley, the term corporeal substance, let's just use the word physical substance. To Berkeley, he would say that's a square circle. Because it doesn't have substance. I know we use the word substance loosely in the modern world to mean, see? You know, but that's actually not very thoughtful. Okay, because then as we're going to see, you strip that down and you've got nothing there. So to him, corporeal substance is a square circle. So the question might become, how do we take in such objects if that's the case? He would say we do so by the senses, just as Locke did. So on this one point, on that one little point, he's actually going to agree with Locke, which is not a very exciting idea because Thomas Aquinas would have agreed to the same thing. So Berkeley is an empiricist in one sense. You're right. Table. You know what? Let's do it like this. Let's do it like this. Big yellow. The reality of the yellow circle, demonstrated by this slightly larger yellow magnet. Boom, idea. And there's a correspondence. Okay, so the empiricists are right that much. Not a very profound idea, though. I don't know anybody that would have disagreed with that. except maybe the rationalist who would reverse that order. That I think, therefore, and stuff like that. But everybody else on this side of the insane asylum wouldn't really disagree with that. So for that profound reason, Berkeley is classified as an empiricist. Yeah, substances out there or objects out there in some sense are replicated in here. Okay, got that. And so, but the problem is Locke had begged all of the most important questions. We can't abstract ideas from sensory data. Because again, sensory data is a square circle. Sensory data, so I have an idea of a water bottle right now. Is that because the water bottle did this? And I had the idea of a water bottle in my head. Sensory data, stuff out there is mute. Okay, there's no data in it. Yes, there is. There's words right here. Okay, you're cheating and you're equivocating. Those words have meaning in here, and we'll come back to that. It's a little bit more complex. But the idea of sensory data is a square circle. The minute particles that pass from physical objects through the senses are not properly data. They remain particles. It is entirely the mind in which ideas subsist, or where ideas subsist. And one can never separate the being of a thing from the perception of a thing. So Berkeley would say that the thing that we're calling a being, or a thing, or an object, is simply not reducible from the abstracted totality of the idea. So the first basic problem with empiricism is the harder one. Let's draw it over here. I guess it doesn't even matter where we put it. Here's the first problem, and that is the problem of objects. Empirical objects are a square circle. Because if I say, what is that yellow circle, or that yellow magnet? Yellow magnet. What do you mean by yellow? You got color there. What do you mean by magnet? I mean sticky thing. What do you mean by sticky? I mean cohesion with something else. What do you mean by cohesion? And you go in circles, and I torture the kids with this. It's a lot of fun. But you take any object. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be a cookie. It could be a dust particle or anything like that. And there's nothing there that's physical. Pick a predicate. Pick a property. It doesn't matter what it is. You strip it down past that. Well, you say, well, okay, I know where you're going. That's molecules. What's a molecule? Well, they're atoms. What's an atom? Well, it's around the nucleus and the thingies going the whatever. And what do you mean by that? Quarks. What do you mean by that? Strings. What do you mean by that? Vibration. Or what do you mean by that? Movement. What do you mean by that? From one place to another. What do you mean by one? Being. So we'll come back to that with Edwards. But Berkeley's point at this point is that in order to talk about anything, you're only ever talking about eternal invisible realities. There's no such thing as material things on their own. He's not saying that the material world doesn't exist. He's saying they don't have substance. What we call the finished idea, the idea of anything. It doesn't matter what the thing is. It could be the whole thing, let's just put 100% thing, or it could be a part of the thing. That thing is a thing with 100% of itself. And you've got the same problem, you just move the same problem inward, more infinitely dense and so on. There's nothing there that's a thing. Okay? Thingness and being has to be eternal. So Berkeley, all Berkeley's doing right now is presenting the problem. And no doubt, it's the harder problem, the problem of objects. So let's just call the first problem of empiricism the first square circle. Both of these are going to be square circles, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago. Empirical objects. Empirical objects. Those two words together should strike you. I know it's a little bit harder. When I say square circle, everybody knows, square circle? Squares aren't circular, and a circle isn't a square. So the two ideas are incoherent. What you need to see about this is that empirical objects are not, in by definition, an object is not an empirical thing. Okay? Empirical thing, same thing. Empirical thing, strictly speaking, a thing is not empirical. That's harder, and I understand that. I gave you the 2-minute version of something that's pretty hard. Here's the easier one to see. This is a more famous problem with empiricism that Berkeley pointed out. See if my brain wakes up. What did I call this? It's the thing about properties, but what did I call it? Empirical data? Did I really call it that? I might have. I'll wait till I get to it, because I had these fancy names for it, those two square circles a couple weeks ago. I should really write that down so I don't have to go on memory. But I'll come back to that one. That's actually the easier one to understand. But let's just get this idea before we move to the second one. What he's saying in his idealism, and this is going to sound spooky at first. This is going to sound like Deepak Chopra or something like that. And you're going to say, no, no, no. In fact, you might say, wait a minute. Is he a subjectivist? Is he saying it's only in your mind? And he's not, I promise. Just bear with him just for a second and you'll see it. What he's saying at first is that to be is to be perceived. To be is to be perceived. So let's put over here the subject. Remember that picture I had over there? So the subject. And let's put a tree, because that's the picture I had then. And by the way, this is a person. I'll put an eye there just to give you the idea. And he's looking, and he sees in the world a tree. And hopefully his idea of a tree actually replicates the idea. And what we meant by that picture is that this is the object, and this is the subject. And so when you hear him say, to be is to be perceived, or objects are entirely in ideas, you're immediately going to say, wait a minute, aren't we taking back the subject-object distinction? Isn't he being a subjectivist, not an objectivist? That'll be the first part, the first thought in your mind as you think through this. So let's just work through this really slowly to see where he's going. To be object is to be perceived subject. So what has he done so far? He's moved objects. It looks at first like he's moving objects indoors, and he's saying that objects actually only exist, one way to say it, is in the subject. But he doesn't want you to say it like that. He wants you to say that objects are ideas. So let's put an idea cloud as a circle around both of these things. He's not saying that the actual tree is in your brain. He's not saying that. Bear with him. I promise this is going to get good. Because this is going to be misleading at first. To be is to be perceived. Here's how he avoids subjectivism. Subjectivism is avoided in Berkeley's thinking. Because in God, the object and the subject are one. Now, if it was just us, if he said that to be is to be perceived, all objects are only in minds, and the only minds that existed were finite minds, then that problem really would exist. Because then he would be saying, those things are only in mind, in your minds. So, in all finite minds, if that were true, if to be is to be perceived, well then of course, perception would be the cause of the nature of things. Our thoughts would determine the way things are. That's not what he's saying. But of course, this is naturally why so many confuse Berkeley with subjectivism. They're reading him through the already messed up philosophical lenses of the empiricist. If we join the empiricist, if we join the Enlightenment in reducing philosophy to epistemological method, in other words, where I start, and then Berkeley comes around and says that to be is to be perceived, well, then the only category we're going to have is to hear that my own perception or your own perception creates being, or that objects are nothing but my own perspective. Not what he's saying. Not his point. Now, it may be that his emphasis, he's so trying to attack Locke that he doesn't bother to draw this out as well as later people would. For Berkeley, there is no objective material realm independent of ideas. So hold that thought, because there's a way to redeem that claim that Edwards is going to cash in on. But Berkeley left hanging. As I said, he talked about ideas to the exclusion of he allowed spiritual beings, but he mentioned it in passing, but he didn't really draw it out. He still wanted to emphasize that ideas can only be analogies of other ideas, not of material substance, because there's no such thing as material substance. And he called this principle the principle of analogy. So, ideas, if they're true, where's the other black one? There we go. Ideas, if they're true, can only be analogies of other ideas. So here's another mind right here. He called the principle of likeness, or at least historians of philosophy have called it the principle of likeness. So ideas, if they're true, can only be analogies of other ideas, not of material substance, because there's no such thing as material substances. Those things are always changing. Those things are never themselves. What we mean by a thing is always an invisible, immaterial, eternal object. The example we used in the class on Descartes and rationalism was that wax, where Descartes was getting you to look at this wax. It was a candle. Is that it? Yeah. It was a candle. And then he says, look at this candle. This is wax. This is a candle. It has dimensions. It has a smell. Has a taste, if you're weird, if you want to taste it, if you want to test out all five senses. And he says, but hold it near to the flame. And every single one of its properties begins to change. You know, this wax. Eventually, you can make it into the shape of a soap dish or whatever. But you notice that at every point, it's wax. So if all the properties are changing, where do I get off calling this thing wax or a piece of wax? Okay, that's the example that Descartes used to point this out. But Berkeley's just saying that's true about everything. Okay, so everything that's changeable. So that's the key there. So let's go to Locke's second problem, the more famous critique that Berkeley offered to Locke's empiricism. And this one's easier for philosophers today to understand. And that is the distinction that Locke made between primary qualities and secondary qualities. And that was a completely bogus distinction. The example, I have a picture in the children's notes today, not in yours. It's a box of Rice Krispies. And the reason I picked Rice Krispies was because what is there that you can taste and hear? I can't hear a banana. I could drop it. And then I thought, snap, crackle, pop. I thought, aha, I'm going to use Rice Krispies. So I had a box of Rice Krispies right here. And then I have this over here. And the reason I was looking for that is because the defining difference between primary qualities and secondary qualities, according to Locke. Okay, so let's just put empirical qualities. I don't even remember what I said. So, but the point is, that's going to be a square circle too. So it doesn't matter because that's going to be a square circle. Okay, so the difference between primary qualities of a thing and secondary qualities of a thing to an empiricist is that with primary qualities, you have things that are really solid, you know, like size and shape. I mean, that's the same for everyone. I look at it and I can verify it. I can break out a ruler and so on and so on. Weight. I can put it on a scale. We can verify those things. Those are primary qualities of those objects. Secondary qualities, I got my ear over here. I got my mouth over here. So taste and sound, if I was to close that door, we would hear a thud, but maybe if you were over there, or if your hearing was shot a little bit, we would all hear something totally different. So, defect and perspective. Those two things. Defect, like jaundice, that's going to affect the sight. And so when I see that, the secondary qualities are those qualities that are bound up in our either the defect of our senses and that difference, or our perspective. We're standing at different places and so on. And so that creates a problem. So if I was to ask you, what did you hear? And you could replicate that sound. And then I say, well, what did you hear? And you could replicate those sounds. Would those be the same things? No. So secondary qualities present a problem. It's never the same thing. But Locke said, that's okay because there's primary qualities by which these things. Well, what's the problem with that? How do those get in here? The same front doors and side doors, namely the five senses, seeing, sound, taste, touch, and smell. In other words, size and shape are doomed to the same quicksand and black holes as taste and sound. And so Berkeley was saying the distinction between primary qualities and secondary qualities is entirely meaningless, because if these are doomed, sound and taste, these things, size and shape, come in through the same front door. You say, that's silly. If somebody weighs something, you put them on a scale. Yes, it's true, you're looking at the scale this way and I'm looking at the scale this way. But we're going to see the same 200 on that screen from different perspectives. And so at that point, the empiricist survives in the modern world by saying, well, we can't be certain about anything, but we can be high degree of probable, my brain isn't working, probabilism, probability, whatever. We have a high degree, such a high degree of probability that you'd have to be insane to deny that thing. And that's kind of the way they do their philosophy. You'd have to be either wicked or stupid, as Dawkins said, to deny the 200 pounds right there. Okay? But that's the problem of empiricism. There's no certainty. Okay? But if you really take it to its extreme, you realize, and here's what Berkeley said, is that what Locke's ultimately saying, and Locke admitted this at the end of the essay concerning human understanding, and Bertrand Russell, the most famous 20th century atheist, so basically a late empiricist, admitted the same thing. He said it's a problem. If this is true, if our ideas are only ever a product of sense data, then it follows that our ideas are only ever about our own ideas. They're never actually talking about the full object outside of our minds. Locke admitted that, but he was okay with that because he was sure that nothing else could possibly be true. Okay? Sure. Which is an idea about something. He's certain, but there's no certainty. Aha! Okay? So the two basic problems of empiricism are that empirical objects and empirical qualities are square circles. Those two words together are a meaningless, incoherent combination of words. Okay? Berkeley also was not a rationalist. I have a section on that. There is a difference between rationalism and idealism. It may not be obvious at first glance, but essentially it's this. For the rationalist, you just reverse the order. It starts in the mind. I think, therefore. Therefore, everything. For an idealist, it doesn't start with my mind. It starts with ideas. You say, well, what's the difference? Ideas are in my mind. Well, you see these two minds right here? The reason that A has to equal A, this principle of likeness in Berkeley, is that when we're asleep, there's a mind that is never asleep. And that's the mind of God. And so this circle, these two ideas that are conforming to something, but there's no material substance, what are they conforming to? It can only be other ideas. But you can't have an infinite regress in ideas. Okay? And so what Berkeley would say is that God's mind, God's ideas of everything, are what hold up. The problem is he didn't draw that out. He just kind of left you hanging. He attributed it to God, but he didn't explain what he meant. Well, there was a guy who came after Berkeley. His name was Samuel Johnson. Not as famous, but he was sort of a disciple of Berkeley during his time in New England. And he was so affected by Berkeley that when it was time for him to go to college, he went to Yale. But then after he went to Yale and studied with Berkeley a little bit, read his books, he then went to England. And when he was at England, at Oxford and Cambridge, he abandoned his Puritan upbringing, converted to Anglicanism, because that's what you do all the time, almost always, universally. And he started to read the books of the Cambridge Platonists from the century before. And so they were into Plato, but they were just in the 17th century. And he took these ideas back home, and he became the first president of King's College in New York City. And that would later become Columbia University, and it was renamed for the same reason that the Anglican Church was renamed the Episcopal Church, because during the Revolution, they didn't want all these British titles attached to anything anymore, even though the British had very much taken over America. By the way, you know, it's sort of funny, isn't it? There's a sense in which the English apostasy won the American Revolution. In the same way that the Cold War was actually won by the communists, not the free world. People don't know any of this. They think the good guys won both of those wars, and it's actually not true. The Anglicans took over New England even before Edwards got there. But that's a story for history class. You should come to history class. It's fun stuff. But anyway, Johnson broke rank with his one-time mentor, Berkeley, over the issue of giving ultimate explanation of what ideas are, because Johnson was saying, in effect, that's a nice circle, that's all consistent, but people are going to want to know, what do you mean by the mind of God? And how does that solve this whole problem? Well, for Johnson, he said Plato's a really good guide here. Except that what Plato called the forms, the ideas, are actually ideas inside the mind of God. So, I won't work with that picture anymore. Plato, in all of his writings, but the most explicit picture that Plato gives you is in Book 6 of the Republic, where he basically says that all of these things down here, whether it's a, let's just pick justice. If I say that was a just act, and that was an unjust ruling, or that was a just war, and you get the idea, so on and so on and so forth. Those adjectives only make sense. Those things are only true if there is such a thing as justice. And of course, if justice is what it is, it has to be unchanging, it has to be invisible, it has to be immaterial, it has to be abiding over all these things. These things actually have to conform to something that never changes. And he did that with beauty and goodness and so on. And Plato called these the forms or the ideas. In Greek, ideon means ideas or forms. That's what Plato called them. And they exist in heaven. And in one of his other books, the Timaeus, he has what kind of a creation myth. And he called this god the Demiurgos. That's where the Gnostics got their idea of the creator god, the Demiurgos. And what the Demiurgos did is when he created the world, he looked at this blueprint of the forms. He looked at justice. He looked at beauty. He looked at all these things. And he created the world based on that eternal pattern. Well, that's true. God did create the world based on the eternal ideas. But Plato, in Book 6 of the Republic, he moves the problem of diversity in the world and he tries to unify it by giving us all these forms in heaven. But he says, they're kind of like this. Justice, beauty, but they got to orbit around something. So let's call the main form the good, kind of like the sun. The good, being. Well, it's true, goodness is being and these are all, but he split them up. Like, separate forms. And so all he did was he moved the problem of unity and diversity. What unifies all of these diverse things and makes sense of them? He moved the problem of unity and diversity, the one and the many. He moved the problem up from earth to heaven. And Augustine most famously said, look, Plato, what you're calling the forms are just the attributes of God. Romans 1:20 says that the invisible things of Him are clearly perceived through the things that have been made. These are not many things. These are attributes of one being, one God. Okay, but Johnson sees this. Johnson's well aware of how Augustine solved Plato's problem there. And Johnson was saying to Berkeley, pleading with him, if you want to make idealism work in a Christian world that still wants to hold on to itself, and Johnson's motivation was to save Christianity from the effects of Locke's empiricism and Newton's closed machine. And he knows where this is going to go. And as an Anglican, as an English philosopher, as someone starting this new nation over in New England now, Johnson's saying, look, if we want to sell this, if we want to save civilization, what we need to do is take a page out of Plato's playbook, but we'll make it the Christian truth, that these are attributes or ideas in the mind of God. Well, he writes a book. It really becomes the first respectable book of philosophy published in America. It was in 1752 called The Elementa Philosophica. So that was Samuel Johnson. And by the way, don't confuse this Samuel Johnson with the famous, more famous Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, who was in England at about the same time. And that was the doctor. He's sometimes just called Dr. Johnson by people like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton and pretty much everybody else that has any kind of Anglican or Catholic background. He's just called Dr. Johnson, one of the great thinkers of the modern world. Interesting character. He had Tourette's syndrome. And he's an interesting character. I'm going to rant about him. But he was the guy that answered Hume's skepticism, which we'll see, by saying, I refute it thusly. And he found a big rock and kicked it. And so that showed that real things do exist. You just have to practically accept them and so on. And he was the one who said about the American Revolution that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. So clearly he was a Tory and he was not impressed by the American Revolution. But anyway, there was one other thinker that was studying at Yale at the same time that Johnson was there. And Johnson and others took over Yale from the Puritans that established it because Harvard had been sacked in 1701 by the Anglican Unitarian Universalists who were using Arminianism as a Trojan horse to move the ball down further toward the Enlightenment. And of course, they got into Yale as well, because the Congregational Puritan churches thought that it was fine to treat these as parachurch entities run by Congregational churches. And that's two strikes. And for their efforts, they lost Yale as well. But at any rate, at first, there was a young student studying there when Johnson was starting to tutor there. And of course, his name is Jonathan Edwards. And Edwards' dates are 1703 to 1758. And I'm only going to give an intro of him today. I wish I could do a whole class on him, but I don't want to pollute him and his genius by getting him too close to all these bad Enlightenment thinkers, because he is operating on a different stratosphere than either the whole lineup of these Enlightenment empty wigs or any of the Christians that came after him. So I want to do one day a whole semester on the thought of Jonathan Edwards. So I'm not going to do that now. But let me just tell you a couple things about him and how he fits into empiricism and idealism. One 20th century historian who was an atheist had a bizarre love and admiration for Jonathan Edwards. His name was Perry Miller. Miller painted a picture of Edwards as a Lockean sensationalist. In other words, Edwards was at Yale when he was in his teens and 20s, this prodigy, this genius, and he's going to the dark corner of the library, and we have no evidence that he read Locke at all, really. We know he read Berkeley and others, and we know he was a genius, but let's just say he did read Locke. But the idea was that he took from Locke these ideas of sensation, and he was this lover of nature, which is true, and all of his sermons and all of his theology is this sort of admirable, profound, secret code that was speaking over the simple heads of the New England masses. So you have this this atheist, Perry Miller, who would agree that Edwards was the most brilliant mind ever on American soil, but that his Christianity and his Calvinism was just this bizarre appendage to it. So a lot of biographers of Edwards afterwards have pointed out that Miller was off his rocker, but it's a thought-provoking thesis. It's entirely misleading. Because, in fact, Edwards retained his Puritan upbringing with absolutely no tension with Enlightenment categories. For the mind, at the center of the Great Awakening, there was what he called a divine and supernatural light that was directly imparted to the soul by God. And that light was illuminated for the Christian soul. In other words, it wasn't just that God was communicating immediately to us his ideas in what Berkeley and Johnson were talking about in general revelation, but the Christian had an infinite advantage in what God was communicating to us. Edwards' most enduring works were The Religious Affections in 1746 and The Freedom of the Will written in 1754, both of which were meant to argue against both guerrilla and open field Arminians, who Edwards knew were laying hell's siege works against the fortress of Reformed Orthodoxy. Ask me about that afterwards and I'll explain that. But it was those brief sketches of his philosophical thought that concern us here. And I'm talking about much smaller, less known works called The Miscellanies, An Essay on the Mind, An Essay of Being, and one on the Trinity. And even a sermon that I have here called A Divine and Supernatural Light. That's one of my favorite Jonathan Edwards sermons. It was first preached in 1734, and there's profound epistemology in that book, as well as a great revival sermon. So how do you put those together? Well, you should read that about 100 times, because it's good. But let's just treat Edwards' God-centered idealism into three parts. We're going to flow from his metaphysics to his epistemology, and I'll do my best to give you the 15-minute version. Edwards on being and nothingness. Secondly, Edwards on power and causality. And you can see why that's number one and this is number two. It's going to flow down. And then, how do we know? Edwards on revelation and reason. Really, really short version. In his essay, simply called Of Being, the younger Edwards, and he's writing most of these between the ages of 18 and 22, and he's just absolutely decimating the entire history of philosophy. And it's unfortunate that he died of that smallpox inoculation what year was it? Whatever it was, 1758, when he went to Princeton, because he had in the works a lot of what would have been the great works of evangelicals after that, but wasn't meant to be. But Edwards, in that essay on being, fired the shot that's never been answered and never can be answered rationally. Namely, this is his quote, that there should be absolutely nothing at all is utterly impossible. Indeed, we can mean nothing else by nothing but a state of absolute contradiction. Now, from that, he derives this, quote, that we see it is necessary some being should eternally be. Now, right there, somebody could say, wait a minute, you're equivocating on some being. Just because I agree, there could never be a point in which nothing exists, the atheist would say. But when you say some being should eternally be, some being, the tight I statement over here, some being must be, or should eternally be, and the type O statement, some being must not eternally be. Okay? That's not necessarily an exact contradiction. An exact contradiction to some being must be would be no being must be. Okay? So you haven't really shown anything. What if it's like a big popcorn machine in the cosmos? And it's true, and everything, there was never a point where it stopped. At least one thing always exists. But it doesn't follow that that had to be one being. Well, Edwards is going to spend this essay showing you why that is not the case. Okay? So, right there when the atheist says, of course there could never be a time or place in which nothing exists, right there, Edwards would counter that the critic just made time and place the necessary being in which some particular thing must always exist. Notice in the atheist's counter, well, of course, there could never be a time or place. Is that a something or a nothing? Something. There could never be a time or place in which nothing exists. So the atheist at that point is assuming, by the words time or place or both, that there's a singular being in which these popcorn, in my analogy, are existing. And so what Edwards is driving at here is that being itself is utterly unlike any other particular being that may either exist or else not. There is a being that by definition must be. He says about time and space that it is impossible that being should be at one time and not another, or in one place and not another. And so this being must be eternal and infinite and omnipresent. Now remember what Berkeley and Johnson said, especially Johnson, as he's drawing back on Plato. He's saying, what about justice, truth? Take any word in those particular things, and you find that that thing must eternally be. The thing that the Rice Krispie box or the tree or those little magnets, the thing that those things predicates are participating in and reflecting. Now, at this point, it might have been useful for Edwards to borrow from Aquinas, which he didn't, but it might have been useful to use this language to distinguish this being from the common notion of this being. The formal conception of space is treated as an attribute of God, and it's done so matter-of-factly that if you read it, it'd be shocking that he's actually saying that this is an aspect of God, because we tend to think of it as a material substance, even if it's just the empty part. But actually, it's geometric. It has a lot to do with presence, too. He moves on to say, and just let this sink in for a second, he says, now nothing is impossible. Nothing is impossible. Now, I can think of all things, lots of things that are impossible. Square circles. I know square circles are not a thing. What you mean by impossible is a contradiction in terms. I know we use the word impossible for all sorts of things. We use it loosely, just like we do all our other words. But what we mean by impossible is logically incoherent, not a thing. Can't be a thing. That which cannot be. That which cannot be conceived to be. Now, from this, it does not follow that whatever is possible is therefore actual. So if something's possible, that like a unicorn, then poof, it pops into existence. That's not the point. That's a shallow way to look at all this stuff. What Edwards does after these first few pages is he has these all these geometric shapes that he's drawing out. You're like, what is he doing? Where did he get? What he's doing is he's demonstrating, he's teasing out the idea of infinite density. He uses number lines going this way, number line in between the point, fractals. He uses all these things to show that the infinitely dense is like a square circle too. He teases the idea down to its own impossibility. And so this is sort of a subtle way of smuggling in an alternative axiom that this being is not simply some being must be, like the popcorn machine. There just so happened to be a thing continuing in existence. But that this one being is that being that must eternally be. Otherwise, there's no proof there at the beginning. And so it's very likely, since these essays were written in a private notebook very early on, that these were the first sketches of what he would have made much more explicit later on. Now, in a more celebrated work, The Freedom of the Will, he would write about this same thing. He said, quote, "It would be in itself the greatest absurdity to deny the existence of being in general, or to say that there was absolute and universal nothing. So," he says, "God's infinity and other attributes are necessary." In other words, necessary for the existence of all other things. He says, "So innumerable metaphysical and mathematical truths are necessary in themselves. The subject and predicate of the proposition which affirms them are perfectly connected of themselves." So the very idea of the subject flowing to the predicate, it must be. When I say God is, if you analyze that, you'll see that it must be the case. The predicate is contained in the subject. Now, Immanuel Kant would later deny all this. He would try to contradict this idea by saying that actually existence is not a predicate at all. And we're going to tackle that when we get to Kant. But that's kind of the way that the Enlightenment world finally got, in their minds, got around all those pesky proofs for the existence of God, is that Kant drew this up in the Critique of Pure Reason, this section on antinomies, and said, predicate is not even, if existence is a predicate, the ontological proof, it follows. But is and am and are is about a particular existence, and it doesn't follow that that particular thing must be. It could either be or not. And so that's how Kant got around it. But anyway, Edwards' version of the ontological argument was much more unique in a few respects than Anselm's or Descartes'. He says, "It is really impossible." It should be. Now, Edwards is going to be, his idealism is going to come into play here. He says, "It is really impossible it should be that anything should be and nothing know it." Remember that tree and remember the object, that objects are entirely in minds. "It is impossible that anything should be and nothing know it. And that is because," here's Edwards' reason, "nothing has any existence anywhere else but in consciousness," end quote. Now, I wish he would have drawn that out much more, but it's clear that he's agreeing with Johnson and Berkeley on that. The objectivity of objects, what we mean when we ascribe things to things, when we attribute something to something else, the objectivity of objects, every predicate we mean by them, is entirely the categories of the mind. And what we refer to as material properties are only the effects of consciousness. Nothing is intelligible apart from intellectual objects. Or to say it another way, here's what Edwards is saying. Objects are utterly the property of mind alone. Objects are utterly the property of mind alone. That's just logically equivalent to say it in the most concise way. Being is mind. And he shows that in his essay on the Trinity. He backs it up with verses like Hebrews 1:3, that Christ, the Logos, is the express representation, an image of the Father. And so God's thinking about himself when he sees the Son. Everything that the Father is, the Son is. Now, that gets into deep stuff that we don't have time for. I'm going to do whole classes just on the essay on the Trinity when we do a class on Edwards. But here's what he's saying. This is getting us to that second dimension of power and causality. If this is true about the necessity of God, the necessity of being, what follows from that is that nothing else could exist apart from that image, apart from God's thinking on Himself, reflecting upon Himself. And what follows is that out of the void that would be there from the infinitely dense, the only way things could exist, over here it's infinite, over here it's infinite, pick a point, any point, you got 1.5, well, what about between that, 1.25? Hopefully you've seen me do this before, 1.125, you get the idea. And where does that stop? Okay, well, if that's true of physical things, if you're familiar with the cosmological argument, Edwards is basically saying that's not just true here on this simple plane, it's true about the infinitely dense. So when you talk about material objects, you're not talking about anything unless or until some thought causes it. Okay? So Edwards is proving in these essays that a word or a decree thinking on Himself has to be the cause of every single thing. Now, I'm being very unfair to you because I'm packing the most profound, fun idea ever into a 15-minute version. I totally realize that. I'm doing it on purpose. I want to whet your appetite so that you're saying, hey, when are we going to do that class on Edwards? Okay? So Edwards is locating the archetype from which God created the world, the thing that Plato was talking about, but he had like in bits and pieces. Edwards locates this idea from which God created the world in the perfect reflection of Himself, namely the Logos, the Son. Not coincidentally, logic comes from that word Logos. He shows how this is manifest in the nature of infinity in mathematics and from the composition of the objects in the natural sciences, that it is a contradiction that any finite thing could be this being. And so it implies a contradiction that anything else could be except that this being upholds everything by His word. Okay? Now, I'm not going to bring you through the intricacies of that, those actual arguments and those proofs in this class, because I can't. And unfortunately, it's 8 o'clock. Not sure why. I just couldn't time-wise. I couldn't do a whole class on Edwards. Like I said, we're going to do a whole course on Edwards. Edwards says the same thing with the end cause, by the way. He writes a book called The End for Which God Created the World. And he proves the same thing with the end cause, not just the first cause. So he already proves it with the first cause being the formal cause. It has to be mind thinking on itself. But then what does God choose on the basis of? Does God just create the... When God thinks on Himself, is it necessary that secondary causes happen? Of course not. Because then those secondary causes would be affecting God. God must be free. Okay, so how then, why are other things made? Well, the only other explanation is the end cause. And what's the end cause? It's the reason or the design, the reason that somebody does something, the end for which I do something. And if you know about Edwards' psychology and the freedom of the will, he says the will is the mind choosing one thing versus another. Well, here's a question. When God created the world or any second thing, anything outside of Himself, on what basis must God act? You say, must? Ah, God in a box. No, He's infinite. There's no box. There's no edges. But if nothing else exists besides God, and God wants to make something besides Himself, what must He base that on? Something in Himself. Okay? And so, that's what Romans 11:36 is getting at. For by Him and through Him and from and back to Him are all things, to Him be glory. So what Edwards does is he painstakingly brings you on these distinctions between a necessary versus sufficient, a chief end versus a subordinate end, and he makes you see that the only possible, the only logical explanation for the existence of any secondary thing is exactly what Romans 11:36 says. By the way, by Him, Father, through Him, Word, to Him, Spirit. That's Trinitarian too. I wish I had more time to get into that. Bad decision on my part. I think I should have done a separate class just on Edwards. All I want to show you right now is how Edwards is an idealist. How he's not an empiricist. Unfortunately, I don't get a chance to get into the sermon, The Divine and Supernatural Light, because there's stuff in there that's super, super fun stuff. And to see it show up everywhere in Scripture and explain the relationship between revelation and reason. Every problem of philosophy you could ever imagine, you can find the solution in these very brief writings by Edwards. I mean, he just smokes the whole playing field of everybody else. and gives you stuff to think about that you can expand on. That's the beauty of it. I think that's the upshot of all this stuff, because I'd say that it's the duty of anybody who sees what Edward saw to say what he was starting to say. I think that's the practical application of this. It's the duty of anyone who saw what Edward saw to say what he was starting to say, because he was just starting to say it. But even what he was starting to say smokes the whole playing field. So with that, let me open it up to questions, comments. Yep.
I have a lot of questions, but it started to bring a lot of things into focus, and it did answer a lot of what was rolling in my mind. I understand what, I can see what this is saying, I can see how it points to an eternal God, but at the same time, I'm having a hard time really just understanding that fact that your idea or what is in the mind is establishing this thing, because it's still a thing. It's outside of.
What did you say when you said established? The verb established. What did you mean by that?
Well, that it is because thinking or being is in the mind.
Right. So when you said established, you mean, so let's take this right. Let's take that bottle right there. So if Barclay, let's just start with him. When he says being is perception, do you hear him saying that my perception causes or constitutes the being?
Well, even though you did keep warning against that.
Yeah, because it doesn't. Because when he says that it is the other, he doesn't say it caused it, but it is entirely the other. Now, I don't have total knowledge of that bottle. So what do you do with that then? So Barclay, I believe, would say, but Edwards certainly would say, that is an effect. So my idea of that bottle is an effect of a greater idea of that bottle.
I understand. Your ideas can change.
So my idea is not causing that in any sense.
Yeah, but it's existence.
God's idea.
Yeah.
So the alternative view is atheism.
Okay, well,
can only be caused by God.
So let's take an example of the wax, though.
Yeah.
It is changing, but it is still wax.
Yes.
So just because its properties change.
But unless you believe this, you can't believe that. You can't say, what do you mean by wax? You don't mean anything by it unless God's idea of it is the cause of it.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah. You can't mean wax unless you believe in the exact God that Edwards believed in. You can't believe in anything unless you believe in the exact theology Edwards believed in. You don't actually consistently believe in anything. You don't believe that anything exists unless you believe in the exact God that Edwards believed in. You can't call it. I mean, we do, and we can, like a blind man lashing out, we can get things right by luck. But when you, what do you mean by that? It turns out we don't mean anything.
It's just the same as saying that the unbeliever can't fully ultimately love.
Right. Love what? Love has to value one thing over another, or it's not love. What do you mean by that? And Edwards talked a lot about excellence and what excellence is.
That's like that exercise where you say, when the rose wilts, where did the beauty go?
Right. Yeah, it can't be in the particle, because the particles don't look too good right now, right?
Yeah.
It's falling away from being.
See, I understand that better than when you say being is the mind.
The way Barclay said it was totally unhelpful, because it sounds like subjectivism at first. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. So I don't want to defend Barclay. I know what Barclay means now, because Barclay's like the reflection on this dirty wood, compared, and Edwards is more like the light. Like, when I hear Edwards tile this together, I have the advantage of believing the same things Edwards does, so I can understand what Barclay was getting at. If I'm a secular philosopher and I read Barclay, I'm like, this is subjectivism.
But he believed in God?
Barclay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like, so he was an Anglican, he was a genuine Anglican, and he seemed to be more conservative than the deists were. I think he was concerned about the deism that even Locke's philosophy was causing.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. And then they form a college after him, and they, you know, I don't want to end that sentence.
So, we're out of time.